I am not so presumptuous as to compare my wintry villages on the Tibetan hills with the exertions of anchorites of Mylarspuilk, yet scenery like that of which he tells is familiar to me. I, too, have lived in caves and huts on high altitudes. Though I did not lack provisions, and had fuel enough to light a fire whenever I wished it, I yet know the hardships of that life. But I also remember the perfect silence, the delightful aloofness and the wonderful peace in which my hermitage was bathed, and I do not think that those who spend their days in such wise need to be pitied. I would rather say they are to be envied. Beside the exercises which I have outlined, there exist a few others aiming at producing tamo. However, they are all more or less alike. The process always combines prolonged retention of the breath and visualization of fire. This, in fact, amounts to autosuggestion. One of the six occult doctrines taught by Naroda, about Naroda, see Disciples of Yore and their contemporary emulators on page 103, is said to have included tamo. Here is an abridged account of Naroda's method. One must bear in mind that, as it has already been stated, such exercises were devised for the use of disciples who had already thoroughly drilled themselves for years in preparatory breathing and other gymnastics. The posture of the body is described as follows: squatting with the legs crossed, the hands passing under the thighs and then clasped together. In that posture, one must 1. Turn the stomach from right to left thrice, and from left to right thrice, 2. Churn the stomach as hard as possible, 3. Shake the body in the way a restive horse shakes himself, and perform a short leap while keeping the legs in the same crossed position. These three exercises must be repeated thrice successively and concluded with a leap, jumping as high as possible. It does not seem to me very wonderful that a man should feel warm after performing this feat. The exercise is borrowed from Indian Hatha yoga practices, but in Hatha yoga treatises it is not connected with the kind of tamo known to Tibetans. The process continues by holding in the breath, until the abdomen becomes the shape of a pot. That very expression I have also heard from Tibetan anchorites. Next comes the visualization of Dorje Nalgyalmo as in the exercise previously described. Then a sun is imagined in the palm of each hand, on the sole of each foot and below the navel. By rubbing together the suns placed in the hands and in the feet, fire flares up and strikes the sun below the navel, which flares up in its turn and fills the whole body with fire. With each expiration of the breath, the world is visualized as being filled with fire. The exercise ends by 21 big leaps. Though there are certain resemblances in the images visualized in these two methods, the difference between them is nevertheless considerable. For while the second includes leaps and gesticulations, the former requires complete immobility. It is not impossible that here, as in many other cases, certain elements of the training have been borrowed from the autochthonous Bonpos occultists. One of the latter once told me that it is the visualization of the fire, rather than the motion of the breath, which produces warmth during the trance. As I did not agree, he added, a man may be killed by suggestion. He may kill himself by autosuggestion. 181. I need not to say that the terms suggestion and autosuggestion are mine. The Tibetan used the words, killed by the power of mind, kill himself by his own imagination. If death can be produced in that way, so much more easily may heat be generated. Inhalations, retentions and expirations of the breath are accomplished mechanically, in the prescribed order, by those who are already well trained in the tamo practice. They do not break the concentration of the mind on the mirage of the fire, nor the repetition of the mystic formula which must accompany the contemplation. These advanced students do not need to make any effort of imagination to see the growing intensity of the fire. In their case, the process goes on by itself as a result of habit which they have acquired, and a pleasant feeling of warmth spreads gradually all over the body, which is the aim of the practice. Sometimes, a kind of examination concludes the training of the tamo students. Upon a frosty winter night, those who think themselves capable of victoriously enduring the test are led to the shore of a river or a lake. If all the streams are frozen in the region, a hole is made in the ice. a moonlight night, with a hard wind blowing, is chosen. Such nights are not rare in Tibet during the winter months. The neophytes sit on the ground, cross-legged and naked. Sheets are dipped in the icy water, each man wraps himself in one of them and must dry it on his body. As soon as the sheet has become dry, it is again dipped in the water and placed on the novice's body to be dried as before. The operation goes on in that way until daybreak. Then he who has dried the largest number of sheets is acknowledged the winner of the competition. It is said that some dry as many as 40 sheets in one night. One should perhaps make large allowances for exaggeration, or perhaps for the size of the sheets, which in some cases may have become so small as to be almost symbolical. Yet I have seen some rispas dry a number of pieces of cloth the size of a large shawl. According to the old rule, one must have dried at least 3 sheets to be a true rispu entitled to wear the white cotton skirt, insignia of proficiency in tamo. But I doubt if the rule is strictly observed nowadays. Rispa means one who wears but a single cotton garment in all seasons and at any height. Yet rispas who slip warm clothes on under their cotton robes are not lacking in Tibet. They are either complete frauds or monks who have really gone through tamo training, but have not pursued it long enough to obtain its full benefits. Nevertheless, though there are frauds and mediocrities, some tamo adepts go beyond the rispa and, rejecting even their cotton garment, live entirely naked in the recesses of the high mountain ranges for long periods, sometimes it is said even for life. Tibetans feel rather proud of such feats and do not fail to scoff at the naked Indian yogins whom they meet when going on a pilgrimage to India. They do not understand that, with Indians, nakedness is the symbol of absolute renunciation and not a display of extraordinary physical endurance. One of these super-rispas who had trained himself in tamo near Kangtais, while journeying over the plains of India with another rispa and a lay servant, from Nepal to Gaya, happened to see a pretentious-looking sadhu lying naked and sunbaked on a mat. "Old chap, you should go naked like that and lie on some offhangs shore, 183. A sacred lake near Kailas Mountain, about 15,000 feet high. Then you will surely pull another face," said the Tibetan anchorite mockingly to the Indian who, of course, did not understand his language, nor why the three travelers irreverently burst out laughing at him. This was related to me by the hermit himself who, in his old age, still enjoyed this little joke of his younger days. In fact, when one begins the training, the phenomenon of increasing heat, or perhaps in some cases, the subjective sensation of warmth, only lasts while practicing the exercise. When the concentration of mind and the breathing gymnastics cease, cold is again gradually felt. On the contrary, it is said that, with those students who have persevered in the training practice for many years, the production of heat becomes a natural function of the organism, which works all by itself, as soon as the weather grows cold. Beside drying wet sheets on one's body, there exist various other tests to ascertain the degree of heat which the neophyte is able to radiate. One of these tests consists in sitting in the snow. The quantity of snow melted under the man and the distance at which it melts around him are taken as measures of his ability. It is difficult for us to get a perfectly correct idea about the extent of the results obtained through tamo training, but some of these feats are genuine. Hermits really do live naked, or wearing one single thin garment during the whole winter in the high regions I have mentioned. I am not the only one who has seen some of them. It has been said that some members of the Mount Everest expedition had an occasional glimpse of one of these naked anchorites. In conclusion, I may say that I have myself obtained remarkable results from my small experience of tamo. Messages sent on the wind. Tibetan mystics are not talkative. Those of them who accept disciples teach them according to methods in which discourses have but little place. The disciples of the contemplative hermits seldom see their master and only at intervals determined by the spiritual attainment and needs of the novice. A few months or a few years may elapse between these meetings. But in spite of their seeming aloofness, master and disciples, especially advanced disciples, do not lack means of communication when they deem it necessary. Telepathy is a branch of the Tibetan secret lore and seems, in the land of snows, to play the part that wireless telegraphy has recently taken in the West. Yet, while apparatus for wireless transmissions are, in Occidental countries, at the public's disposal, the subtler ways of sending messages on the wind remain the privilege of a small minority of adepts in that art in Tibet. Telepathy is not altogether a novelty to Westerners. Psychic research societies have, more than once, called attention to telepathic phenomena. These, however, usually seem to have occurred by chance. The author of the phenomenon was not aware of his part in it. Under such peculiar circumstances, he had sent forth the mysterious waves that had reached, at a greater or lesser distance, a human receiver, but he had not done this knowingly and on purpose. On the other hand, the experiments made to transmit volitional telepathic messages have given doubtful results, for they could not be repeated successfully as often as desired. Things are different among Tibetans. They assert that telepathy is a science, which can be learnt like any other science, by those who have proper teaching and are fit instruments to put the theory into practice. Various ways are mentioned for the acquisition of telepathic power, though Tibetan adepts of secret lore are unanimous in ascribing the cause of the phenomena to an intense concentration of thought. One may remark that as far as telepathy has been observed and studied in Western countries, its cause has seemed identical with that discovered by Tibetans. Mystic teachers declare that mastery in telepathy requires a perfect command over the mind, in order to produce, at will, the powerful one-pointedness of thought on which the phenomenon depends. The part of conscious receiver, always ready to vibrate at the subtle shock of the telepathic waves, is considered almost as difficult as that of the sender. To begin with, the intended receiver must have been tuned with him from whom he especially expects messages. Now, volitional perfect concentration of mind on one single object, until every other object vanishes from the field of consciousness, is the basis of the Lamaist spiritual training, and this training also includes psychic exercises that aim at developing the power of detecting the various currents of energy that are crossing each other in every direction. So some affirm that telepathy, as well as tamu and other kindred accomplishments, is a natural byproduct of the spiritual training and, consequently, need not be studied separately. This also explains the power with which all great Gomchens and Dubchens 184. Literally a great successful one. This must be understood as one who is possessed with supernormal powers. The equivalent of our term magician. 184 are credited, of communicating with their disciples, whatever may be the distance that separates them. However, some see the matter in another light. Though they agree that proficiency in the spiritual training brings in its train proficiency in minor accomplishments, such as telepathy, they think that those who are not able to reach the high stages of the mystic path may rightly cultivate telepathy or other byproducts separately. Mystic masters agree to this to a certain extent and, in fact, a number of them train their disciples in telepathy. A number of Tibetan anchorites have become able, without having undergone any special training, to catch the telepathic messages of their guru. This is commonly considered as proof of their great devotion to him. A few have spontaneously acquired the power to emit messages. As for those who cultivate telepathy, the main lines of the training may be sketched as follows. First, it is necessary to go through all the practices devised to produce the trance of one-pointedness, the concentration of thought on one single object and complete oblivion of all other things. The complementary practice which consists in emptying the mind from all cogitations, establishing in it complete silence and blankness, must also be mastered. Then comes the analysis and discrimination of the various influences which cause sudden, apparently inexplicable, psychic or even physical sensations or moods of the mind, such as abrupt feelings of joy, of melancholy, of fear, and also sudden memories of persons, things or events apparently unconnected with anything going on around one. When the pupil has exercised alone for a time, he may sit in meditation with his master in a silent and darkened room, the thoughts of both being concentrated on the same object. At the end of a given period, The student tells his teacher the phases of his meditation and these are compared with those of the master. Concordances and discrepancies are noted. Now, stopping, as far as he can, the activity of his mind, emptying it of all ideas, reflections and mental representations, the novice watches the thoughts which arise involuntarily and unexpectedly in him without being apparently linked with any of his present preoccupations or feelings. He notes the subjective images which appear. And, again, at the end of the meditation, thoughts and images are made known to the Lama teacher, who sees whether or not they correspond to those he mentally suggested to his disciple. Then, the master sends mental orders to his disciple, while the latter is at a short distance from him. If these are duly received and the student answers by acting accordingly, the exercise continues, the distance between master and disciple being gradually increased. It is believed in Tibet that Dobchens are capable of reading the thoughts of others at will. The master being credited with such a power, it would be absurd to train anyone to send him telepathic messages. The very intention of sending them would be detected by him before the messages had actually been sent. Whether this power is real or not, the master is compelled to act as if he possessed it. Consequently, his disciples practice the exchange of telepathic messages among themselves. Two novices or a number of them associate for that purpose under their teacher's supervisions, and the training is very much like that described above. Novices test their progress in dispatching unexpected telepathic messages to one another at a time when the person designated is likely to be busy and not thinking about receiving communications. They also try to convey messages to people with whom they have never been connected through training in common, and who know nothing about telepathy. Some make experiments with animals. Years are devoted to these practices. It is impossible to guess how many of the students who pursue this study really obtain results from it. Whatever may be the fruits they reap, the most worshipful among mystic teachers do not encourage this kind of exertion. The efforts made to acquire supernormal powers are considered by these masters as uninteresting childish sports. It seems proved that great contemplative anchorites are able to communicate by telepathy with their disciples, and some even say, with any sentient being, but that power, as already stated, is considered as a mere byproduct of deep insight into psychic laws, and of spiritual perfection. It is said that, when on account of the enlightenment acquired through various contemplative meditations one has ceased to consider one's self and others as entirely distinct entities, devoid of points of contact, then telepathy is easily practiced. The discovery, during prolonged introspections, of these points of contact leads to a sphere in which delimited beings vanish and only continual exchanges are perceived. These are psychic and mystic experiences which words cannot describe. Whatever may be the share of truth or fancy in such theories, I prefer to avoid discussing them. One thing I may say, however, is that communications from mystic masters to their disciples through gross material means, such as letters falling from the ceiling or epistles one finds under one's pillow, are unknown in Lamaist mystic circles. When questions regarding such facts are put to contemplative hermits, erudite lamas or high Lamaist dignitaries, they can hardly believe that the inquirer is in earnest and not an irreverent joker. I remember the amusing reflection of a lama from Tashilhunpo when I told him that some filings.Filing means a foreigner in general, but Tibetans apply the term specially to Englishmen, the only white foreigners they know excepting Russians. The latter they call Eroso and not filing. It is believed in such ways of communicating with departed ones or even with Tibetan mystic teachers, and these are the men who have conquered India. He exclaimed, utterly amazed at such simplicity in these otherwise redoubtable Englishmen. Relying on observations which extend over a large number of years, I shall venture to say that Tibet seems to offer peculiarly favorable conditions for telepathy, as well as for psychic phenomena in general. What are exactly these conditions? It would be presumptuous to attempt defining them while the very nature of psychic phenomena is still so mysterious. Maybe the very high level of the country is helpful. Perhaps we may, also, take into account the great silence in which the country is bathed, That extraordinary silence of which, if I dared to use so strange an expression, I would say that it is heard above the loudest voices of the most furiously roaring torrents. Again, solitude might be reckoned with. The absence of big crowds whose mental activity creates many whirlpools of psychic energy which trouble the ether. And perhaps the placidity of Tibetans whose minds are not filled, like ours, with cares and cogitations is another of these favorable conditions. Whatever may be the causes at work, telepathic transmissions, either conscious or unconscious, seem to occur rather frequently in Tibet. Regarding my own experience, I am certain that I did receive on several occasions telepathic messages from lamas under whom I had practiced mental or psychic training. It may even be that the number of these messages has been larger than I suspect. However, I have only retained a few cases in which the lama afterwards inquired if I had understood what he meant to tell at a given time. Beside communications regarding spiritual matters, which may not be entirely due to telepathy, but to a certain identity in the trend of thoughts between a master and his pupil, I may relate two incidents of an entirely different kind. One of them happened in the Dangshin River Valley, during my journey to Lhasa. The lama, who produced what seemed to me a characteristic telepathic transmission, belonged to the monastery of Chostzong. Yongden and I had spent the night in the open, sleeping in a ditch dug by the waters during successive rainy seasons, but for the moment dry and hardened by the frost. The lack of fuel had compelled us to start our daily tramp without drinking our usual hot butter tea. So, hungry and thirsty, we walked till about noon when we saw, seated on his saddle carpet, 186 Tibetans ride on a padded saddle with a carpet over it. When a traveler alights to rest on the road, this carpet is often spread on the ground for him to sit on. Near the road, a lama of respectable appearance who was finishing his midday meal. With him were three young troopers of distinguished mien, who looked more like disciples accompanying their master than common servants. Four fettered horses were trying to graze on some dry grass near the group. The travelers had carried a bundle of wood with them and kindled a fire. A teapot was still steaming on the embers. As befitted our assumed condition of beggarly pilgrims, this journey was effected in disguise. At the skirt of the immense primeval forest that extends from Tigan to the Kunkah Pass, six travelers had joined my small party. The region is known as being haunted by daring Tibetan robbers, and those who must cross it look for opportunities of forming as large and as well-armed a company as possible. Five of my new companions were Chinese traders. The sixth was a Bonpungagspa, a tall man whose long hair, wrapped in a piece of red material, formed a voluminous turban. We respectfully saluted the lama. Most likely the desire that the sight of the teapot awakened in us could be read in our faces. The lama muttered, "Ning," and, aloud, told us to sit down and bring out our bowls. Tibetan travelers always carry a wooden bowl in the breast pocket formed by their dress tied with a belt. Wealthy travelers keep the bowl in a case which is carried by an attendant. A trooper poured the remaining tea in our bowls, placed a bag of sampan near us and went to help his companions who had begun to saddle the beasts and make ready to start. Then, one of the horses suddenly took fright and ran away. This is a common occurrence, and a man went after the animal with a rope. The lama was not talkative. He looked at the horse that ran in the direction of a hamlet and said nothing. We continued to eat silently. Then, I noticed an empty wooden pot besmeared with curd and guessed that the lama had got the curd from a farm which I could see at some distance away from the road. The diet of daily tsampa without any vegetables proved rather trying for the stomach and I availed myself of all opportunities to get milk food. I whispered in Yongden's ear, "When the lama is gone, you shall go to the farm and ask for a little curd." Though I had spoken very low and we were not seated very near to the lama, he appeared to have heard my words. He cast a searching glance at me and again uttered sotto voce, "Ninged." Then he turned his head in the direction where the horse had run away. The animal had not gone far, but was apparently in a playful mood and did not permit the trooper to capture it easily. At last it let him throw the rope round its neck and followed him quietly. The llama remained motionless, gazing fixedly at the man who advanced toward us. Suddenly, the latter stopped, looked around and went to a boulder nearby, where he tied his horse. Then he retraced his steps a little way and, leaving the road, walked to the farm. After a while I saw him come back to his horse carrying something. When he reached us, the something turned out to be a wooden pot full of curd. He did not give it to the llama, but held it in his hand, looking interrogatively at his master as if saying, "Was that what you wanted? What am I to do with this curd?" To his unspoken question the llama answered by an affirmative nod, and told the tripper to give me the curd. The second incident which I will relate did not occur in Tibet itself, but on the borderland territory that has been annexed to the Chinese provinces of Sichuan and Gansu. Anxious to glean anything that I could regarding the religion of the country, I invited the man to share our meals in order to find an opportunity of chatting with him. I learned that he was going to join his master, a Bonpa magician, who was performing a great dathab on a neighboring hill. The object of this rite was to coerce a malignant demon who habitually harmed one of the small tribes which live in that region. After diplomatic preambles, I expressed my desire of paying a visit to the magician, but his disciple declared the thing utterly impossible. His master must not be disturbed during the full lunar month necessary to perform the rite. I understood that it was useless to argue with him, but I planned to follow him when he parted with us, after crossing the pass. If I succeeded in coming unexpectedly upon the magician, I might perhaps have a glimpse at him and at his magic circle. Consequently, I ordered my servants to keep good watch on the Ngagspa so that he could not leave us unnoticed. Probably they spoke too loudly among themselves about the matter. The Ngagspa saw through the trick I intended playing upon his guru and told me that it was no use attempting it. I replied that I did not harbor any evil intention against his master and only wanted to have a talk with him for the sake of enlightenment. I also commanded my servants to keep a still closer watch on our companion. The Ngagspa could not but be aware that he had become a prisoner. But as he also understood that no harm would be done to him and that he was well fed, a thing to which Tibetans are keenly alive, he took his adventure good-humoredly. "Do not fear that I shall run away," he said to me. "You may bind me with ropes if it please you. I need not go ahead to inform my master of your coming. He already knows all about it. Ngais lung jiai ten lalen tang za. Ngagspas are in the habit of boasting of so many and such various miraculous powers that I did not pay any more attention to his words than to those of his colleagues in the black art. This time, I was wrong." When we had crossed the pass, we entered a region of pasture land. Robbers were not much to be feared on these wide tablelands. The Chinese traders, who had clung to us day and night while in the forest, recovered their assurance and took leave. I still intended to follow the Ngagspa, when a troop numbering half a dozen riders emerged from an undulation of the ground. They rode at full speed toward me, then dismounted, saluted, offered katag and a present of butter. After the polite demonstrations were ended, an elderly man told me that the great Bonpa Ngagspa had sent them and begged me to renounce my intention of visiting him, for no one but an initiated disciple ought to approach the place where he had built his secret magic kayaka. I had to give up my plan. The Ngagspa, it seemed, had really informed his master by sending a message on the wind. To persist would have been useless. Even if, in spite of the proof of his strange ability the disciple had given me, I still doubted that the master's occult power was strong enough to prevent my progress, I could not ignore the sturdy armed hillmen that surrounded me. They were most respectful and certainly meant to be as pleasant as they could be. But their attitude might change if my obstinacy should jeopardize the success of a rite that interested a whole tribe. So, I gave a complimentary scarf and some silver to the Ngagspa to be presented to his master. I congratulated the Tibetans on their good luck in having secured the service of a first-rate magician and we parted on friendly terms. Visual telepathy seems also to be known in Tibet. If we could rely on the stories told about famous lamas by Tibetans, we should find in them many examples of such phenomena. But truth and fiction mingle freely in these tales, and one feels inclined rather to doubt than give credence to any specially unusual event. However, there exist men today who affirm they have beheld visions transmitted to them by a kind of telepathic process. These are quite different from the images seen in dreams.